In talking about Ramakrishna, and we're going to wrap up that conversation pretty quickly today. In talking about Ramakrishna, has anybody perceived any particular problems in sort of the assertions being made about, I've practiced all religions, and all religions are true in the sense that they all lead to the same divine experience? Has anybody perceived any difficulty with that general statement he makes? I practiced Islam, I practiced Christianity. It's a very powerful statement, had big impact on a lot of people. But I just wonder if, yeah,
well,
and then I'll get... Okay. I mean, that would be my own perspective also, but Ramakrishna is making that assertion on the basis of some experience he had by doing certain things. And that's kind of, that's what I wanted to look at. So, Forrest, what's your view?
I agree with, like, a good amount of what he's saying. And he seems like a very intelligent person. I don't, maybe it's just, like, the writings or whatever. It just, he comes out as very righteous, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't remember him ever specifically or anyone saying that people were specifically wrong, where I've heard other people saying, hey, you're wrong. He was like, he feels very, like, he is right.
And
he
does?
And that all religions are approximately equal. And that sounds right, it sounds good, but there's also no... doesn't seem a lot of room for you know, different sides of arguments, which is...
Well, of course, most religious teachers who have personally experienced God, let's set aside the whole question of which God they experienced or whether they experienced multiple gods, but most religious teachers who've had a personal divine experience, a transcendental experience, a vision, whatever you want to say, they don't, on the whole, tend to sound like they're a little ambivalent about their views about things. They usually sound pretty definite, pretty certain. I mean, these kinds of experiences seem to convey a kind of absolute certitude about things without any kind of wishy-washiness left over. I mean, think about the Old Testament, the prophets of the Old Testament, you know. Some old geezer's wandering around watching the sheep or something like that, and all of a sudden, gablooey, the skies open up, the word comes down, gets knocked on his butt, and the message is, you know, go see the king and tell him to shape up his act. Okay, so you think about the Old Testament world, what it would mean for some old guy to, you know, go to the court of King Saul or King David or Solomon or something like that and say, God talked to me and said, you better shape up over here because you're going to be in trouble if you don't. I mean, in those days, it was sort of like, take him out and remove his head from his shoulders, please. You know, I mean, there was no, right? So it you had to have a lot of, right? And it was, so when you look at the prophets in the Bible, I mean, that's the image of like thundering certitude kind of thing, right? I'm not saying that's right or that's wrong. I'm just saying that people who have these kinds of experiences kind of, they tend to feel pretty definitive about things, you know. That doesn't make them right either. It just means that they're pretty definitive about things. I mean, think about the apocalypse of St. John. So modern Christians, you know, look at the book of Revelations. Look at the book of Revelations is what we're talking about. Now, in the ancient days, when they were putting the Bible together, right, they were trying to decide whether or not to keep it in there. Like, a lot of people said, we don't want that in here. That stuff? No, we don't want that in here. Right? There's some pretty complicated, weird, scary stuff in there, right? Creatures with many heads and arms, and heaven opens up, and flames come down, and all kinds of stuff goes on. Makes you wonder what was going on in that guy's mind. Now, I think he was having real honest-to-goodness spiritual visions. I'm not, you know, I say these kinds of things in the way I do just to be humorous, but I think John was like, you know, there's some powerful stuff that showed itself to him. But as Hicks says, everybody sees things through their own cultural filter. I mean, that's not, we know that's not his language, but that's my language for what he's saying. Everybody sees things through their own cultural filter. And sort of this is kind of getting closer to the question of that I was just asking about Ramakrishna. So John's cultural filter included things like the horror of Babylon, and you know, you wouldn't expect that in other parts of the world. Trumpets sounding in heaven. I can't think of any Indian yogis who heard trumpets. They heard a lot of stuff, but no trumpets. So, you know, there's like this cultural filter that experience goes through, and Hick makes this very strong case that there's no way to have religious experience except with that filter. And so that sort of is the issue then with Ramakrishna is he's essentially saying that Hick is wrong. He's saying if you have religious experience of the impersonal, there's no cultural filter associated with it. And therefore, he's capable of stepping into another culture, like Muslim culture, because there were Muslims, there are plenty of Muslims in Calcutta. He could step into Muslim culture and have a Muslim religious experience. Now, Hick would say, wait a minute. His whole life, he's a Hindu. He's Indian. He speaks Bengali. He's a temple priest. How is it possible that he's going to experience anything the way a person would experience who'd been raised a Muslim? And so this is sort of an interesting problem because, again, Ramakrishna's argument, I'm not going to take a position here, Ramakrishna's argument is if you have direct experience of divine reality in its formless character, you have stepped outside of everything associated with your culture. And the reason for that is culture is something that's embedded in our mental process. And if you can get into the place that is subtler than mental process, a position of awareness upon which mental process sits, if you will, to use that kind of model that we saw in yoga. I talked about the chariot metaphor. This is one of the reasons I talked about that metaphor. Ramakrishna is saying you can get into this consciousness space, which is unformed and is subtler than all cultural imprints. Therefore, you can experience that which is common to all cultures. And Hick, of course, says that's not possible. But Hick is stuck in the rational mind. Hick never gets beyond the rational mind. So he logically deduces, and he rationally deduces his views of religious plurality. So that's a good thing, and that's an interesting thing that he does that, because you can follow his train of thought, and it's sound. Ramakrishna doesn't do that. And that, to wrap it up finally, that is the whole reason that I contrast these two people. And their positions, in a sense, are irreconcilable. And we are not in a place where we can test them in any way that I know of. I mean, how would you test that? I mean, we can think about Hick, and we can think about the Hick's logical train of thought to religious pluralism. But unless we give up everything in our ordinary life and start meditating like crazy so that we can have the kind of samadhi experience that Ramakrishna had, we have no way to know what he's saying. We have no way of knowing we can't test what he's saying. I mean, that's the issue. That's really what I want to get to. Western science is founded on the replicability of experiments and the testing of hypotheses through replicable experiments. And the reason that introspectionism was rejected in psychology, which was an approach in the late 19th century, early 20th century, was my internal experience, I was pointing at myself. You can't really know anything about my internal experience because it's not something that can be replicated. So in no way can that experience be used to test out a hypothesis. So science says, well, whatever that experience is, there's nothing we can say about it. as scientists, there's nothing we can say about it. Maybe if I happen to be a poet on the side, I could say something about it. But as a scientist, I can't say anything about it. That's the issue. Now, that's, I think, in some ways changing, because there are now mechanisms for looking at mental activity. You know, the electroencephalograph essentially has gotten so sophisticated in the way in which it is related now to the way in which computers can model encephalographic behavior, brainwave behavior, that we can actually see things that people couldn't see before. So if the hypothalamus is active in a certain state of mind, we can actually see that. 50 years ago, when I was a graduate student, you couldn't see that stuff. Well, it wasn't 50, anyway. Almost 50 years ago, when I was an undergraduate student, you couldn't see that stuff, right? So it was like, it was off the chart. You couldn't deal with it. But now you can see that stuff, and it's back on the chart. But nirvikalpa samadhi is not going to be on the chart, as far as I can tell. Not because you couldn't hook somebody up to some monitor for looking at it. It's because there are not that many people around who can get into that state, so you can't really judge. There was a period of time when people started to look at meditators because they wanted to know what was going on in their minds, and they'd hook them up with these kinds of earlier versions of electroencephalographs, and then they would do that for a few weeks. They would look at their brain behavior, and they'd write some article about this. And they take people who'd been doing transcendental meditation for 3 months, and they take a look at what's going on with them. Three months, that's like, you know, spending 2 days learning how to ski and then saying, you know, what kind of a skier are you? I mean, it's insane. The more recent studies have been done with Tibetan monks who've been sitting in caves for 40 years meditating. Well, those are people who know what they're doing. Looking at what's going on with their brain behavior is much more interesting and producing much more interesting data. I mean, that was actually the sort of simplistic attitude of the researchers rather than anything else. All right, so I'm going to leave it at this point. I've already gone down on a sidetrack. The main point was what I was speaking about in regards to Ramakrishnan and Hick, that these are sort of like two approaches that stand in contrast to each other. And if you will, you can almost think of them as like experimental methodologies or experimental approaches. The whole point is we're looking at data points. The whole point is we're looking at data points. We've got three data points now on the problem of religious pluralism: the Eck data point, the Hick data point, and the Ramakrishna data point. So now we're going to look at a fourth data point, which is the Dalai Lama data point.